Hello, and thank you for joining me for the seventh episode in our special series of podcasts spotlighting the Arizona Institutes for Resilience at the University of Arizona and their work with individuals, businesses, and communities to manage risks associated with climate change and discover opportunities associated with solving the climate crisis. Today, we're talking about carbon and the economy. How climate change and the economy are connected, I would say inextricably bound, and what we all need to know about market-based solutions to climate change. This is a complicated and important topic, so please stay with me. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Impact Earth. The title for our podcast today is Climate Change and the Economy. The price of carbon. So radical transparency, everyone. In my almost 15-year journey of learning and growing and educating myself as the founder and voice of Mrs. Green, fully understanding the topic we are covering today has been one of the most challenging for me, and I know for many others. So with us today, putting him on the hot seat and having him be the person that demystifies all this is Derek Lemoine. And he is Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Arizona. He is also a Research Associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research and an Associate Fellow of the Center for Economic Policy Research. His research explores how uncertainty should affect the design of climate policy, the interaction between energy systems and innovation, and how to incentivize carbon removal and other topics. So that's his research, and we're going to be able to dive into some of that. And also noteworthy to me is that he received his PhD from UC Berkeley, and that always is a bonus for me. I happen to be a big fan. So Derek, welcome. Thank you for taking the time to be here, and you have a big task ahead of you, which is educating Mrs. Green and our listeners about a complex set of issues.
My pleasure, Gina. Thank you for having me, and thank you for spotlighting AIR, and thank you for all the work you're doing as well.
Well, I just love it. And this is, I mean, Dave and I were talking. It's really, it's big stuff to me. So let's start with, according to the World Bank, carbon pricing is an instrument that captures the external costs of greenhouse gas emissions, the costs of emissions that the public pays for, such as damage to crops, healthcare costs from heat waves and droughts, and loss of property from flooding and sea level rise, and ties them to their sources through a price, usually in the form of a price on the carbon dioxide emitted. So I guess my first question to you is, and you can kind of like, I want to say, take it away, Derek, is how is that as a definition, and what do you want to add? I mean, carbon pricing for most people, men and women on the street, it's like deer in the headlights and their eyes roll back in their head. Let's be honest. Carbon pricing, please don't talk to me about that.
I think the fundamental idea is actually fairly simple because we pay for things all the time. We live in a market economy because we believe prices do a pretty good job of signaling how valuable things are and how costly they are to make. And most of the time, markets work pretty well and are probably about the best algorithm that we know of for how to allocate resources. Algorithms are only good as the data that goes into them, you know, garbage in, garbage out. So when there are important costs that are missing, then the market backfires. And these are the external costs that are referred to in the definition you gave. So the idea is that if there's not carbon pricing, then the use of the atmosphere as a storage dump for carbon, it does impose real cost. It causes warming effectively forever, which then impacts economies and people and biodiversity effectively forever. Those costs are real costs. They're not part of the market costs. They're not part of the cost of the energy we use and the goods we buy unless we force it to be because the atmosphere is effectively there and free. So the whole trick of policy is how to make the markets work properly, how to stop acting as if carbon were free and actually make the market see the real cost, exactly like they would see the real cost of, you know, using additional rubber or something like that.
So when I think about this, I think about being with my friend Jim Beiser and him pulling out a napkin when we're having a cocktail and him saying, okay, Gina, here's this, here's that, here's this. When I was preparing for this show and reading a lot about it and really wanting to get a grasp on this whole concept, I had this vision of there's a scene in Harry Potter. How could I bring Harry Potter into this discussion in one of the shows where they're down in the bank and there's all of these, you know, these little men writing and putting notes in the bank and all of this stuff. And I think, who is figuring out the price of carbon and what it should be? How do you explain that to me?
That's the tricky part. Well, there's two tricky parts. One is actually getting a price. The other is then what should that price be if we got it? So let's ignore the politics side of it, like why we don't have much of a price, and just pretend like we actually were going to implement whatever we thought the right price might be.
Right.
So right now, carbon's free, therefore we use too much of it. Let's try to price it properly. What should that price be? And this is what a chunk of my work is on and what a legion of other economists study, because this is a really hard question. If you think about what it is you need to know, you have to know the value in today's dollars, so how much, depending on how much we care about the future, of all the future costs imposed by today's carbon emissions over all future time. So emitting a bit more carbon today causes a bit more warming in every year, effectively from tomorrow out to infinity, as far as we're concerned. It also acidifies the oceans by a little bit from tomorrow for some very long amount of time. And the fact that there's more warming and the oceans are a bit more acidic affects fisheries, it affects agriculture, it affects energy, it affects where people live, it affects sea level, it affects everything. And so what you want to do is measure the economic cost of all these effects, which are not just lost GDP, they're not just lost output.
Right.
They're also the fact that we also care about non-market things like ecosystems, even if they don't directly affect our material quality of living. And we have to figure those out in every possible state of the world, you know, kind of take the average outcome out of all these possible states of the world, do this for every future time period, add them all back up, and compound all that uncertainty and all those future effects into a single dollar number we can impose today. So it's completely trivial, right? I mean, like five-year-olds can do this.
No, it's not. It's not. And when you say impose on who? On the offenders? On the people that are emitting the carbon? Because that's another part of the you know, I watched this 60-minute special the other night, which made me so sick. Like, I really thought I was going to throw up. I'm barely kidding. About how much oil is still being emitted into the Gulf from the oil spill that started in 2014. And what a joke. Like, what a joke. So I know that's oil. It's not, you know, greenhouse gases. But there's a way to make that company pay, and they're working on that. But when you talk about a market-based way to control pollution, that means somebody's paying for it. And there are market-based solutions, and economists prefer them. So go down that rabbit hole with me.
Yeah, first to clarify, I was completely joking when I said this is trivial. I think we don't have any idea what this number is. And I can talk for long time about why we don't know and about how the fact that we don't know should actually be part of the number as well. And that's part of what I work on. And I show that fact should actually increase the number. But I think all we know is the right number is not zero. It might be fairly small. It might be incredibly large. Like, we really, anybody who told you they knew for sure would be lying through their teeth or just misinformed. In terms of where to impose the price, it turns out there's a bunch of ways you can do it. The key thing is to get the price in place. It doesn't matter too much. There's a bunch of effectively equivalent ways of getting the price in place. The two most common ones are what's called either taxing carbon or doing cap and trade, which is what the U.S. Congress at least passed the House and almost passed the Senate about 10 years ago.
I remember that.
Years ago, maybe now.
Yeah.
And so the in either fashion, what ends up happening is usually easier to do for logistical reasons at the point of emission, because we can track, you know, if carbon comes into fuel, you combust the fuel, carbon combines with oxygen in the air, comes out as carbon dioxide. You kind of know, it's really hard to hide the carbon. Like, that carbon happened.
Who the culprit is, yeah.
Exactly. So it's easy to apply the tax or the cap and trade scheme at that point, and the effect throughout the whole economy is pretty much equivalent. Like, all the prices throughout the economy respond to that fact. But basically what would happen is you have a monitor. So imagine a power plant. It's burning coal and emitting. It's got carbon dioxide coming out of the smokestack. We currently do monitor this carbon coming out. Every power plant in the U.S. has what's called a continuous emission monitor that's tracking a whole bunch of pollutants coming out. You know the carbon coming out. At the end of the year, you tally it up and you pay a price per amount, times the amount that you emitted. Cap and trades, very similar. Just at the end of the year, now you have to turn in a given number of permits corresponding to the carbon rather than just paying a tax per unit. And but you can buy and sell those permits in the open market. So those permits had a price attached to them. And it turns out that to get the same, that if the permit price is equal to the tax, you get there's a mapping between the two, that the permit price is doing what the tax would have done. They end up being the same policy in the end to a first approximation.
So at this point, I mean, this is like totally going off I don't want to say off the reservation anymore. It's not the right thing to say, but you know what I mean? It's not off topic, but basically what this is a way that economists prefer it because there is a way to come to a cost and to assign that cost to the offender or the polluter or whatever. And then is that why it has such an impact and an application for mitigating climate change? Is that what the key is?
This is really important. So the reason why economists like a carbon price is not because it's easy to calculate, because it's most certainly not.
I can't even imagine. Don't even ever tell me how we would begin to calculate that.
It's certainly also not. I mean, it's not even like the calculation's hard. It's just we don't even have the data. Like we haven't run the experiment yet. We haven't lived through climate change. The reason why we like it also isn't that we think that it's politically easy or that it's effective in making like polluters liable. Because again, to first approximation, you can impose the price at different levels of the economy and it doesn't really matter. It doesn't have to be the polluters themselves who pay. What the reason why economists like it is that once carbon's priced, the markets are working properly and people throughout the economy, firms and people throughout the economy, see the true price of carbon in all of their decisions. So if you think about other things you might do might be, I'm going to just pay for renewable energy. I know the right direction of travel is to have less coal and more solar. So
right.
I'm going to pay for more solar. Okay, that's probably one thing a carbon price would do is solar does not produce carbon effectively, so it wouldn't really change much due to a carbon price. Coal produces a lot, so it'd get a lot more expensive. We'd use a lot more solar, a lot less coal. But if carbon price does other stuff as well, in that it natural gas looks better compared to coal, but worse compared to solar, but it just promoting solar doesn't do anything about the natural gas coal margin. Things like nuclear or wind or other technologies we haven't even thought about that might be carbon free would also look better than coal at the carbon price. But without a carbon price, you'd have to kind of know to choose them. If you just pay for more solar, you actually might be making energy cheaper. But part of what a carbon price does is it makes energy more expensive insofar as you need, as you're burning carbon intensive energy. And that also incentivizes people to then conserve energy where reasonable by buying more efficient appliances and not using energy when you don't need to be using energy, in which, you know, you want that incentive. Like part of this is going to be an expensive problem to solve, and you want to be pushing on every margin at one time by using cleaner energy and using less energy where reasonable and innovating in cleaner technologies, which a carbon price sends a signal that if you work on cleaner technologies, you'll have a market for them. And again, that's kind of the right thing to be doing. As one other example, imagine that you said that I want to deal with transportation by requiring cars be more efficient or by requiring that all new cars be electric vehicles. The problem with the first is that you're going to incentivize people to drive more, which could even mean that you use more gasoline in total, but at least is sort of working against the goal you're trying to achieve. A carbon price also incentivizes more efficient cars while also incentivizing driving less, all else equal, to the extent your car is using gasoline. And the problem with just requiring electric cars, there may not be better than gasoline cars everywhere, depending on how you charge your electric car. And so you need to choose you need to incentivize people to charge them properly and figure out where people should be using them and not. With the carbon prices, this is all part of the market. If your electricity is really carbon intensive, electric cars aren't going to look as attractive. If your electricity is really relatively carbon free, electric cars look relatively attractive compared to a gasoline car. So you're getting the right signals with a carbon price without having to think about it all, which is why we use markets in the first place.
Which is why people like me don't want to think about it. And it's so funny because I have an electric vehicle. I am so blessed to have Chapman Automotive Group as a partner, and they provided me, this is my first all electric vehicle.
Oh, cool.
And I mean, it is cool. And when I'm in like at a dinner conversation and people have like the courage to get me started, like some people say, don't ask her anything. No, don't get her started on that. Don't bring that up. But my real friends, when they ask about the complicated piece that you just mentioned about electric vehicles, not to me, it's wonderful. I have not gotten gasoline on my hands, on my car, on my feet in almost 2 years because I don't go to the gas station, right? Mm-hmm. However, that energy has to come from somewhere. And when we're at dinner and people start asking me that, I say, can someone get me another glass of Prosecco or something like that? Because it's like, it is a very complicated conversation. Mm-hmm. It is, and it's what you're saying. So let me just throw this there at you. And please, you know, please respect me at the end of the show, by the end of the show. So I'm thinking about how do we calculate the price of carbon? Because to me, way back when we first got computers, and that's how I'm telling you a lot about my age, there was this game that went around where it said, you know, you clicked on the dot. It wasn't even a game. I thought it was real, like click on the dot to get the answer, and the dot kept moving. You couldn't click on the dot, which was the whole point of someone sending it to me. I kept saying, oh, I don't have my clicker on the right spot. That's how I feel about carbon pricing, because nothing in what you would calculate is static, because there's another flood, and then there's another big yep. mega fire, and then there's another tsunami, and then, you know, on and on and on. So it's a moving target. How does one or 1,000 of you economists and scientists, how do you begin to calculate the carbon price? Is there even an answer to that?
There is an answer because we do it, but I would say you need to respect me at the end of the show because I'm going to explain to you why we do it very poorly. Because as I mentioned earlier, I don't think we have any idea what this price is, and I don't believe that we can know. I don't. Like I said, we haven't run the climate change experiment yet, so we're not going to be able to know ahead of time. And it's a hard enough question, even looking backwards after we've been through a lot of climate change, it would still be hard to really know. But I'll try to unpack this a little bit for you. I think I can paint a picture about both what we do and where the holes might be. So roughly what we do, this is essentially what the Nobel Prize was given for in 2019. I might be off by a year. Bill Nordhaus got the Nobel for developing these climate economy models that are the benchmark way of estimating the carbon price. And roughly what they do is they couple a very stylized model of the economy to a very stylized model of the climate, probably more stylized in the economic side than on the climate side. And so roughly the way the models are put together is that you have you're basically baking a pie in like every year and every time or every decade, every time period. And this pie is like the total amount of economic output you have. And then in every period, you have to decide how you want to slice this pie up. You know, what part am I going to eat today? And this is our objective, is over time to eat as much pie as we can. What part am I going to save for the future and there have more pie tomorrow that way?
Right.
And what part am I going to spend and basically throw away in order to reduce the emissions I made as part of baking the pie? And the reason why I might choose to throw some pie away today to reduce emissions is that as those emissions turn into warming through the climate system, that's going to reduce the size of the pie that I bake in the future. So basically, I have two ways of saving for the future. I can choose to just save some of my pie and invest it in having more pie in the future.
Right.
Or I can save pie today and invest it in not having as much global warming in the future. And either one of those, I'm trading off against eating more pie today. And this is roughly the way these models are put together. Mathematically, it looks a little more intimidating than that, but that's roughly the way they're put together. And then you have to optimize over these decisions, and through that, you find the value of having more emission reductions today, and that's the carbon price. The thing that people used to focus on 20 years ago about the really complicated or the big hole in these models is that they really hinge on how much you care about the future, right? Like if you think that future generations aren't that important, then climate's essentially a problem of how many costs are we going to bear today to help the future, both near and long term, out as carbon turns into warming. And if you don't care much about the future, that you're not willing to bear a lot of costs today. If you care a lot about the future, you're willing to bear more costs today. And that could just be an ethical choice. Like, it's not quite clear how you should pick the parameter that, that governs that. That obviously is an issue, but we have some idea how one could make a choice, and ultimately it's a political decision. You've got to take a stand on what you think the right level of patience should be. I think there's a bigger hole in the models, and I think, I mean, not just me, I mean, others would agree with me as well. We have no idea how the mapping from, so I save pi today to reduce emissions, but I allowed some emissions. So in the future, the air is warmer around my oven, and that reduces the size of the pie I can bake in the future. That's the part we don't know. We have a decent idea how much warmer the air is going to be around the oven. What we don't know is what that means for the size of the pie we can bake. We really just don't know what future climate change is going to mean for the economy. So contrary to reputation, economists don't like making numbers up. We strongly prefer to tie numbers to data. So in this case, what's the data you would use? So you would want to have seen a whole range of different temperatures and seen how the total amount of pie you could bake is different in all sorts of different temperature environments. But the whole point of climate change is that the climate is changing. We haven't had human society in anything remotely like the climate of, I mean, almost even today, but certainly now within a few decades. So we don't have a good experiment that we can look to for data. So one thing you might do is you might say, well, parts of the country are warmer and parts are cooler. Let's compare, and parts of the world are warmer and parts are cooler. And let's compare how economies and people do in different climate zones. That can work. The problem, I mean, it's nice in principle, but the problem is that a whole bunch of other things change with cooler and warmer places. Like Iowa and Arizona are different, not just because Iowa's really cold in the winter and cooler in the summer, but also because we have different soils and histories and institutions and everything. Like you can't just attribute everything that's different to the climate. So what people prefer to do is to look and say, well, let's look within Iowa and try to figure out how climate change is going to affect agricultural output, let's say. And we're going to look within Iowa, and some years in Iowa happen to be cooler and some years happen to be hotter. Now they're all within Iowa. They're all got the same soils, the same people, the same history, the same crops, the same everything. Just randomly, the weather turned out cooler and randomly the weather turned out hotter. And let's see, oh, look, extreme heat is bad for crops. Moderate heat is good. Extreme cold is also probably not good, but like some level of heat is good, but too much heat is bad.
Right.
So now once we know that relationship and we can predict how heat's going to change using a climate model, we can now say in the future crop production is going to change in this way. It's just by multiplying the effect of weather times the change in weather from a climate model. That seems semi-reasonable. It's grounded in data. At least it's not purely making a number up. The problem there is that I would argue, and I would say more than argue, I think I would say I've shown mathematically that the experiment of changing the weather randomly is very different from the experiment of changing the climate permanently. And it's very different for two key reasons. One is that climate change is something that we see coming. So the actions that we take to prepare for it are very different than the actions that you might take to prepare for like a randomly hot year, even if you saw it coming, which you may not have seen it coming.
Right.
So
right.
This ability of humans to kind of act in preparation, which is all the adaptation you talk about in your show, is a very big part of it. The other big part is all the stuff we do to react to the change. At some level, it might not be obvious that it would be different. If the year is randomly hot, whether because of a random weather event or because of climate change, maybe we react to the randomly hot year the same way either way. What I'd argue is that we actually gonna react very differently with climate change. Because even if you don't see it coming, just getting to react year after year after year leads you to do different things than if you react to a one-off event. So over time, you start adjusting. And maybe you adjust in ways that mean that you have irrigation that's better suited to dealing with heat. You've got more air conditioning, so the extreme heat matters less the second time than the first time. It could also be that you adapt by doing things like using more groundwater, and you can't do that for 20 straight years, although you could do it for one random year. So there's different ways this effect could go, but either way, doing it year after year is very different than doing it to a one-off hot year.
And it's interesting to me. There's so many thoughts going through my head as you speak. And what's scaring me even more is that I'm starting to understand this. That's like terrifying. But talking with great minds and great friends and mentors to me, like Skip Leitner, I mentioned it to you. We've done interviews with him. And Jim Beiser has been one of the most impactful people in my life in terms of this journey, even when it comes to conversations about COVID and so much of that. But we were talking one time and he said, you know, people refer to this as a 22-year drought. And he said, Gina, it's not a 22-year drought. Welcome to the new climate. And that was like, you're right. When people, it's not like the drought's going to be over next year. That's that to me is like the flip of the conversation when it comes to big things like this, which is carbon pricing. We're not going to go back to 40 days and 40 nights of rain, I don't think. And even then, that wouldn't be enough. Someone said, well, it rained a lot this summer. And I looked at them and I was very nice. And I said, yeah, but that we needed 22 more years of that or something like that. And not being judgy, but just thinking if you only knew how bad it is. And also I want to point out, and I think it was Jim that said, the difference between weather and climate. And weather is when you go outside, this is what's happening. And climate is a measure of that over time.
Yep.
And it really matters that we look at how climate behaves over long periods of time.
Yep.
And that's what you're saying. It's like you can't just take one chunk, and I'm never going to feel the same about pie again either. So thanks for ruining that one for me.
Pie is overrated.
No, it is not. Not in this family. Excuse me. Especially with...
Now I found a controversial topic, apparently.
Yeah, especially if with pumpkin pie season coming up next week, and it's one of my specialties. So I want to go a little bit deeper here.
Yep.
In my intro, I said that your research explores how uncertainty should affect the design of climate policy. So that's a very intriguing conversation. How do you answer that? How does your research, it is such an uncertain thing. I mean, such an uncertain thing. So how do you talk about that research and go a little bit deeper with us for that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'll be happy to. And let me back up one second and explain where the uncertainty comes from.
Right.
So thank you for giving a shout out to Jim and Skip. They're both great. And Jim's a true Jim for sure. What he is getting at about human adaptation is spot on, that if it were true that we could just look and see what randomly hot years did to the economy and to nature, we might be able to get a decent estimate of the cost of at least like small amounts of climate change, maybe not extreme climate change, but some small amount. The problem is, and this is where economics comes in, like people are messy, like people do stuff. And all these human responses just compound these uncertainties and are really hard to estimate from data when we haven't run that experiment yet. So that I'd say there's three levels of uncertainty that most people think are the most important. One is just, what is future economic growth going to do? What kind of technologies are we going to have? What's our standard of living going to be? And that matters for a few reasons. One is that it affects what future emissions are going to be and what future warming would be. It also affects how much we're willing to do today for the future. So if you think in 50 years, everybody is going to be driving flying cars, living for 200 years, and be perfectly happy, healthy, beautiful, and wise, then you might be less willing to bear costs today to help them out, because they're doing pretty well. But if you think, on the other hand, that things are about as good now as they'll ever be, and we're going to be a lot poorer in 50 years, then you might be a lot more willing to help our future selves out, right? This matters from an equity perspective. And we have no idea. Like we have no idea what economic growth would be over a 10-year time span, nevertheless a 50 or 100-year. The next one is uncertainty about warming. This is the one that's easiest to measure in a lot of ways, because this is the scientific uncertainty of just how much warming does a unit of carbon turn into over time. Obviously, there's a chunk of uncertainty about it, but you know, it's fairly well constrained and pretty well studied. It's more of a physical science problem, but that is one layer of uncertainty. We don't understand the extreme possibilities as well as we'd like, but at some level, we roughly have some handle on this. And then the third one, which I'd argue is and have shown quantitatively is the most important one, is that uncertainty about what does any given change in climate mean for the economy? How much should we care about a given change in climate? And that's the problem I was alluding to earlier. We just cannot know that ahead of time. And as much work as we put into it, I mean, hundreds of papers now are being written trying to estimate the damages of climate change. I would argue that's just irresolvably uncertain, and the bounds on that uncertainty are so wide. Climate change might matter very little to people if they don't care as much about the natural world and are able to insulate themselves fairly well from the climate with new technologies, and you know, richer countries may not be that exposed. On the other hand, there's a plausible world where any given amount of climate change, like 3 degrees of warming, is terrible for everybody, no matter what your income is. Like, there's a whole wide range of possibilities in here, and where you fall in that could really drive your carbon price. So the way I approach it is we deal with uncertainty all the time. Like, it's not like uncertainty needs to paralyze people. We make decisions involving time and uncertainty every day. And one standard place we do this is anytime people invest in anything effectively. Take a stock market. You're investing in something that's going to pay off over time with a good amount of uncertainty attached to it. And people price this uncertainty literally every millisecond as there are trades happening in the stock market. We have pretty good theories for how this happens. We understand how it should work and to some extent how it does work. And those exact same theories about how people should approach decisions under uncertainty and valuation under uncertainty apply to this question of valuing the future damages from climate change. So as a brief insight into what it looks like, one of the things that matters the most, so if you think about investing in a stock, imagine I'm offering you two different stocks, and I'm telling you 50-50 chance in next year or over the next decade, the economy booms, and 50-50 chance that it goes completely bust.
Right.
And I'm going to offer you two stocks, and I'm going to say they're going to both do, one's going to do very well when the economy is booming, but do horribly when the economy is going bust, and the other one is going to do just as well as the other one did, when the economy is going bust, but do horribly when the economy is booming. Most people would prefer to have the one that does extremely well when the economy goes bust, because you'd rather lose your job but be making money off your stock rather than lose your job and not be making money off the stock, but make money off the stock when you do have a job. We like the insurance. We like the hedging from not having these two things move together. It turns out that the way that you think about uncertainty with carbon emissions mostly boils down to the same type of thought experiment, where it's, if I think about what are my payoffs from reducing emissions today, it's that in every future year, we get a bit less damages from warming because there's a bit less warming going on. So the question for how uncertainty matters is, I mean, obviously, first, how much uncertainty is there? But second, it's are the benefits from having less damages from climate change, are those benefits going to be larger when we otherwise happen to be relatively rich as a person or society or planet? Or are those benefits larger when we happen to be relatively poor? If it's the second, then uncertainty makes us really happy to cut emissions because they're acting like a hedge, right? We're getting more benefits when we were otherwise poor. On the other hand, if they pay off more when we would otherwise be really rich, then that might make us less willing to reduce emissions because it's not the kind of hedge, it's not the insurance that we prefer to buy. What I show is that the most important kinds of uncertainties make this look like insurance, like a hedge. Like, you could imagine a story where the most important thing is economic growth and so worlds where we're really rich are worlds with high emissions. And it could have been the case that worlds with high emissions are worlds where the benefits from cutting carbon would have been the greatest. Well, in that case, you get your benefits when you're relatively rich anyway, so you're less excited about cutting carbon. It turns out that not only is that story a little bit incomplete, but more importantly is this uncertainty about the damages from warming. And what's really important about that is that if damages from climate change turn out to be really high, that the economy is really sensitive to each unit of warming, and maybe even that each unit of warming is really sensitive to how many emissions you released, or total warming sensitive to emissions, then in that case, worlds where you're reducing emissions matter a lot by reducing warming and damages, or worlds where we're relatively poor because of climate change, worlds where reducing emissions didn't matter as much because we got lucky and they didn't either they didn't cause a lot of warming or warming didn't matter that much for the economy and for nature, then those are worlds where we're richer because there wasn't as much climate change. And it turns out that that's the most important effect because we're so uncertain about the damages from climate change. And once you account for that uncertainty, whatever you think the carbon price should be, I show, at least using standard estimates, it's a pretty robust effect that you get an increase, if I remember, something like 30% added onto the price of carbon just from recognizing uncertainty, which almost every model to date hasn't done.
And that just like, it kind of takes my breath away because it is just such a moving target. But there's like, I'm sitting here trying to write as many questions as I can and still be fully present and listening. But the smart ass question I want to ask is, if I was lecturing in a big hall, I'd say, okay, if you think climate change doesn't affect the economy, please raise your hand. And if anybody did, I'd say, okay, this class is probably not for you. So you might as well just like opt out. As an economist, as an expert on answering the question, how do we know how does climate change affect the economy? Because it does. I can't think of any way that it doesn't, but I'm immersed in the whole climate change conversation from the minute I get up to the minute I go to bed, and I'm barely kidding. Like, if I use a paper towel, I'm like, uh-oh. When you live in this world of the future is scary. I don't want to use the word scary, but it is. I mean, there's a lot of things we have to be looking at. So as an economist, how can people not think it doesn't affect the economy? It does. Climate change is driving the economy, if you ask me.
So I think if you take a survey of economists and just got, especially, I mean, I'll restrict it to economists who think about this topic. So economists climate change and the environment. If you took a survey of economists who do this and you asked them, or actually, I think this is probably true of all economists, but and you asked them, just give me your single best guess for whether climate change is going to hurt or harm the economy, almost everybody's single best guess is going to be harm. The main question is going to be just how much, how right? Because how much is really important if you're trying to price carbon? Is it going to be a little bit or is it going to be a lot? But I think your question is sort of like, what's the opposite story you could tell? And I want to emphasize a lot of the uncertainty I referred to is really the uncertainty about how much it's going to harm.
Right, right.
But part of the uncertainty is also about whether there would be harm. So there is a strand of literature that projects some small benefits, at least in more northern countries, from smaller amounts of climate change, possibly even including the U.S. or parts of the U.S. And if you wanted to try to think about how an economy could benefit, I think you want to start with two ingredients. One is already being fairly cold. So a lot of humanity lives in areas that are certainly colder than any temperature humans would have evolved in, and certainly colder than temperatures that are optimal for agriculture. And so as those temperatures warm, humans can settle and do a lot more things, and there's a lot more opportunities for agriculture in those areas. And then on top of that, I think that's roughly the thought. So like so there's some work that basically looks at GDP and how that relates to temperature. And that I have a lot of thoughts on this literature. I don't know that I would take it too literally, but they do show this sort of hump-shaped effect where there's a temperature in the middle that's optimal for GDP, for lack of a better word, for humanity, right, for lack of a better word. And too cold is not good and too hot is not good. And there are countries that are on the left side of that curve that as they warm, they're going to be doing better. Again, I wouldn't take that too literally. Like, everybody's affected. There's a whole bunch of channels for conflict spillover and such. But there are certainly ways in which warming will help some places. And I think it'd be hard to argue that some places aren't going to benefit, at least in certain ways, even if not in total.
And to your point, it would have to be like a very isolated computation. Like, because even if you're country or your state or your province is benefiting because it's warmer, you have to get supplies from someplace and things have to be shipped in. And we are a global economy and the systems are all connected. So I agree with you that there could be an upside, but then you're part of a global economy that has an impact. And that's more of like my thinking now. And I'm thinking about what's going on here in Arizona, where is our headquarters. And then thinking about a friend of mine who lives in Michigan and it's been snowing there all week. And I'm thinking, snow, what is this word snow of which you speak? But, you know, all of this is part of this global conversation. And it just, I mean, I'm enthralled with all of it. So money, if it's not about the money, it's about the money. And I guess that's more of my point. If you are living for that short-term gain on your stock market. You're not a player, a long-term player. And my brother's a financial planner, and he says, don't look at your portfolio every day, which I never did anyway. I didn't never have a big enough portfolio. But that's not the way to stay in the game and to ultimately win. And it's that curve you're talking about. When it comes to climate change, we are all players on that stage. All of us, every single one of us, whether you're an economist or a believer or not, what we do impacts the climate, and what we purchase has a price that I think climate change is impacting almost everything. Everything we eat, certainly, and the price of, let's just say, paper towels or toilet paper. The shortage of trees is going to impact that. It just, you know, I can find a connection for climate change to pretty much everything. And I'm not an economist, but I live with that belief that we have to affect the design of climate policy in light of the climate change realities that I've seen in my lifetime. And I would hope you agree with that.
I think you're highlighting the role of markets, and I want to elaborate on the role, on both roles you're highlighting, both in terms of how markets propagate effects and in terms of how markets can help us actually reduce climate change as well. Like you were referring to how markets can propagate problems from parts, like let's say Canada and Russia, let's say their agriculture might benefit. And I would argue both countries are well aware of this, including some other possible benefits they might get. So, and then your argument would be that a lot of the other parts of the planet are going to be messed up, and on net, they're not going to be better off, and may very well be true.
Right.
I want to highlight that this is part of the role of markets in adaptation, that just as markets may prevent the winners from maybe winning quite as much as they thought they would, markets are also going to stop the losers from losing quite as much as they thought they would. So, for instance, if you have a good market in food, part of what markets do is they insulate you from having one shock to weather in your backyard, because they allow places that can grow more food in a given year to sell to places that could grow less food in a given year. And that's going to be really important with climate change as we reorganize the production of everything, as food, obviously, but literally everything's going to be reorganized in light of this fact. And markets are going to be really critical to reorganizing production to try to keep everybody afloat. And they're certainly going to transmit shocks in the way that you described. But that transmission of shocks is something that's critically important, because if every place has to go out on their own, then each place is way more exposed to the effect of climate change than we should be linked together. The other role of markets is what you described as every decision you make has some climate implication. And I think you're thinking about like the emissions side of it there. And this is going back to why carbon pricing is so important to economists, that you're right. Like climate change is embedded in the fabric of society because it's so entwined with like the fundamentals of how we make energy. It's not acid rain, where it's a byproduct of one particular type of way of making electricity that we could either capture or switch out of. It's not like the ozone hole, where it's like an ancillary chemical that we could switch out of and use a different refrigerant. It's not like a whole bunch of other things that we've, you know, maybe somewhat solved in relative terms. It really does affect every decision, and it's going to be costly to deal with it if we're going to deal with it in the way that we're proposing to. And so rather than pretending that it's not going to be that costly, we need to design policies that try to make it as uncostly as it can be, as cheap as it could be. And the way you do that is you need every decision to take account of the cost properly. And putting a price on carbon is the best way to get all of the millions of decisions that are taken every day throughout the economy to account for the cost of climate change, whether it's, as you described, like a short-termist stock trader who's just interested in today's profit, or somebody who's trying to make the best decision in the supermarket aisle. If the carbon price is set correctly and is collected properly, then the prices of the stocks should properly reflect that price, and the prices of the goods in the aisle should properly reflect it. And you don't need to ask people to just do all these extra computations, because we do the price computations every day anyway.
Right. And we're not going to do it. Most people aren't going to do it. But this is what
we're not going to save the world by having people do it voluntarily.
We're not. We're just not. So this is what just happened. And if you didn't know it, I did. And I'm cracking up laughing at myself. You took my whirling dervish, messy soup, stew, brain question that I had, and you deconstructed it to come up with a really good answer, because I was asking a lot of questions in there, and you made sense of my question by giving the answer in a way that I even understood what my question was. So I want to thank you for that. I think that's the first time.
You just gave me far too much credit.
No, it's not.
Far too much credit.
And I'm sure Dave is cracking up because it's very much me. And I don't usually acknowledge it on the air, but I thought, this guy just made sense out of what I couldn't even get the question out. So kudos to you.
I think your question was much clearer than you're giving yourself credit
for.
I appreciated what you said.
But anyway, no, it's really true. See, so much, and I just dropped something off the desk. So this is one of my favorite questions. And I don't even know if it's a fair question. But when I first started this, you know, I was in... I was like so not on the climate change train 15 or 20 years ago. Maybe I was. I lived consciously because of the way I was raised about waste and leftovers and conserving water because we had a well and all of that. But in terms of what I've dedicated my life to, I, for the first 10 years, believed that, don't worry, Gina. I know all these scientists are saying this, and I know all the numbers say this, and I know it doesn't look good, and consumption has to be blah, blah, blah. But some kid somewhere is going to come in and save the day with new technology, and they're going to be able to draw carbon down because there's so much up there already. The greenhouse gas emissions, that's another one that Jim explained to me. It's like, it's up there, Gina. Because I said to him, well, Jim, this is the dinner conversations we have. So how come if the carbon emissions are heating up, blah, 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 how come it's causing such severe storms in the ocean? And he explained the whole thing to me. It's like, it's coming down in ways when it reaches breakpoint, and God forbid he should listen to this show and hear how I wreck this answer, but I'm not going to tell him. But you know what I mean? It's like, it's a very complicated, we have put so much up there already. The greenhouse gas emissions are way beyond, if we stopped producing them today, there would still be dire consequences for what we've already done. And so, is there going to be, do you see in your work, in your research, in your talking with other economists, do we have any radical solutions that are going to help cool things down or in any way mitigate the rapid acceleration of climate change? I mean, somebody told me yesterday, who's a water expert, that Lake Powell went down 8 feet last month. That is not a happy thought for someone that lives at the bottom of the food chain for the Colorado River. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So what is your, you know, and you don't have to be an expert on this, you as a human being, are we going to be saved or in some way rescued to some extent with great new radical solutions?
So you're right in your description of the atmosphere. As you put carbon up there today, it effectively hangs around there forever. I mean, carbon from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution is still up there and still trapping additional heat. It's the atmosphere can be compared to a bathtub with a very narrow drain. And over eons, it will eventually go back and we'll get back to equilibrium. But we're removing carbon that was buried from hot, high carbon worlds millions of years ago, and we're moving it from underground back into the atmosphere and recreating those hot worlds. And it'll stay like that for a long time. So this is, we have to think both about how we're going to adapt, or I say three things even, like how we're going to adapt to climate change, because climate change is happening and there will only be more of it in the future. We need to think about how we're going to take steps now to limit future climate change by reducing emissions that drive it. And no matter what, I think we need to be thinking about ways to actually undo climate change. And this is something that I've been on since back when I was a master's student. I started thinking about this topic of removing carbon from the air back when, I would argue, almost nobody was thinking about this academically. And even very few, I do not know of a single paper beyond my own that thinks about how to actually incentivize removal of carbon within a framework of carbon pricing or something. So the two ways that people think about undoing climate change, one is what's called geoengineering. So the idea, one idea, which turns out to be disturbingly cheap, actually. It might be better if it were more expensive. But this idea is effectively you shoot reflective particles, almost like a man-made volcanic eruption. You shoot particles up into the stratosphere. They would effectively circle the Earth or at least a hemisphere. They'd reflect a lot of incoming sunlight. They might incidentally dry the planet out, but, you know, at least they would cool the planet pretty rapidly. If you stop doing it, all of a sudden you're going to get a lot of warming because you were hiding warming, so you'd better be cutting emissions while you were doing it. But if things got really out of control, we kind of know we could do this. We don't know all the side effects, but you know, we're pretty confident it could work to some degree. So that's one. I think that's a pretty unattractive way to have to deal with climate change. The other way that might be more attractive, reversing climate change, but will require a lot more work and is going to feel closer to your silver bullet you want, but needs to be done at such a large scale that it can't possibly be seen as the kind of magic bullet you'd like it to be, is what you said. It's literally sucking carbon back out of the air. And there are biological ways of doing it. There are ways of manipulating soils and rocks and the oceans to do this as well. One of the most promising ways to me to do this at scale, so this, for reference, the scale we're talking about is literally billions of tons of carbon dioxide would have to come back out in order to matter. So this is not a backyard project that's going to clean the atmosphere. This is major industrial work.
Right.
Whether it's industrial management of nature or whether it's industry in the way of what I'll describe as literally building machines that suck carbon back out of the air, almost like reverse filters or something. Unfortunately, we don't have great uses for all that carbon. There's only so much coke you can make, but we'd probably end up burying a lot of it underground would be the most likely outcome. But so what I've been thinking a lot about is how I personally believe that we're as likely as not. I would actually say we're fairly likely to be doing this at a very, very large scale by the middle of the century to the end of the century. I've thought that for a while. It just seems like too obvious of a thing to be doing if we succeed in cutting emissions and things are getting bad enough. So I think it's as likely as not we're going to be doing this at scale. The international targets for limiting warming propose that we're going to limit warming to 2 degrees Celsius and ideally to 1.5 degrees Celsius overall. We are very close to 1.5 degrees Celsius. It's really hard to imagine how we could do that and barely possible to imagine how we could do 2 without overshooting them and coming back under them. And so that would mean overshooting them and removing enough carbon on net to actually be removing emissions from the air year by year. So cutting our emissions so low and then removing so much carbon that we're sucking carbon back out on net. I've been talking about carbon pricing as if it's the be-all and end-all. This highlights a big problem with carbon pricing. If you're taxing carbon, then once there are no more emissions, there's nothing left to tax. So taxing carbon does incentivize removing carbon as long as there's emissions to offset, where I can like show you my carbon removal receipt and not pay a tax, right? Or get my tax refunded.
Yes.
Once we've hit net zero, why do we go net negative to avoid paying a carbon tax? We paid the tax 20 years ago when we emitted the carbon. Like, what do we care now, right? So you need a different policy. And I think what a lot of the more engineering types who work in this assume is that it'll just be the government just paying people to do carbon removal. Some back-of-the-envelope calculations they've seen suggest this would be an enormous expenditure. I don't know that I would hang my hat on this number, but they suggest it'd be like the share of output the U.S. spends in defense, which the U.S. is not known for neglecting the military too much. The share of output the U.S. spends in defense at a global level, I think year by year, would have to be spent on carbon removal to get to net negative in the way that people say we should. So we need a market-based way to do this. We can't count on governments just hand out all this money year after year after year to fund all this carbon removal. So what I've been working on is how do you adapt the carbon price to this possibility that you can to do two things, to not only reduce emissions today in ideally the quote-unquote economically optimal way, the way that a carbon tax or cap and trade would or could, but also to incentivize removing today's emissions in the future should that become optimal, which means should damages either become really high, because, and remember, we don't know what they're going to be, so that's possible, or should the technologies to remove carbon get really cheap? And again, that's possible that they can get dirt cheap and it'd be optimal to eventually suck today's emissions back out. Current policy proposals offer no framework for making that happen. So I've been trying to design policies that could do that. And roughly the idea is that you're creating a new financial instrument attached to units of carbon. And this instrument can be traded back and forth. And if you design it properly, it ends up giving you both the incentive to reduce emissions today and like a carbon price, does everything a standard carbon price would do. It prices carbon in the same way. But it's also still around and alive and working and adapting to new information in the future so that it also incentivizes pulling carbon back out of the air in the future if damages do end up being high enough.
So it's like you get me like excited and believing, and you say words like, if it's not about the money, it's about the money. We have to incentivize it. You didn't say those words, but I remember when someone said to me, some ones, many people said, oh, Jeannie, you have to watch Kiss the Ground. You have to watch Kiss the Ground, which is a film about, it's inspiring, it's groundbreaking, a viable solution, which is regenerative agriculture. So I'm still on that train. But even mm-hmm. there, it's what you're talking about. It's going to take money and incentives and big ag to get on board, and it's costly, but it works. I mean, from the charts I saw and the graphics and the things I read, and NASA and NOAA, they're all saying this is a possibility for regenerative agriculture. And to your point, it can't be just one thing. Like, I never heard it explained like you did about if we do carbon pricing and then people stop carbon emissions. That's a big fantasy. How, you know, then what are we going to tax? I understand that. But it, to me, it's the integration of thought for all of these things that's going to help preserve the planet for my 2.5-year-old granddaughter, that I'm mm-hmm. not going to have to... it makes me sad to think that she might have to really worry about access to clean water. And, you know, when you talk about the rich countries, even in the rich countries, you and I know that environmental justice will still be an issue because there'll be the very rich, like the Saudis, let's pick on them, I love to, where they can ship water in airplanes because they have that much money. They have more money than God. I mean, it's like, so they'll have water. Some of those sheiks, they won't have to worry about how many baths they take in a day. But people in those countries where there is a lot of wealth, it's the poor that are going to take it. So I just had to bring up the social justice piece to this because it just further complicates the conversation. And that's like my latest thing. It's like, how are we going to create a sustainable world if we're not saying sustainable and socially just in the same conversation? But that's really a story for another day. So mm-hmm. let's bring it back because I'm good at that. Okay. I went out there for a minute, but I came right back. What are any final thoughts you want to share? I will say this, and I loved this interview. And I don't always stop and say that. And I have witnesses. But I loved your energy. I love your passion. I love the way that as a scientist or an economist, you can speak to people like me that need to understand it because we vote, because we lobby, because we have means. We have some modicum of power. I still believe that I have some power left. So what... are there any final thoughts you like to share? Because you get to do that. Words of wisdom, whatever. I wish Gina had asked me this kind of thing.
Wow. let me think about this. Thank you very much for having me on. I think I want to emphasize again that we often think of climate change as a scientific or a technical problem, and it is obviously both of those. If we didn't know the science, we wouldn't be aware there's a problem. And all the solutions obviously involve technology, whether it's switching to other technologies or using technology to scrub carbon from the air, there's obviously a technical aspect to the problem. But if it were just scientific and technical, we could solve the problem. Like, we know how we could get to even net negative. Like, we now have the suite of technologies. We know how to do hydrogen and electric cars and clean electricity and carbon removal and all everything else. Like, it's not purely technical. A lot of the problem is actually economic. It's actually that costs matter. Costs indicate real resources. People around the planet do not all live equally well. Not everybody already has a high quality of life. If you believe climate change is an important problem, you should probably also believe that it's a problem that's going to be costly in order to actually clean it up in the way that you think it needs to be cleaned up. And if it's going to take a lot of real resources to clean it up, then you want to be really smart about not wasting resources to do so. This could be an incredibly costly problem if we clean it up inefficiently. It could be much less costly and maybe not even all that costly if we're smart about how we clean it up. And being smart about how we clean it up is where I think economists have the most to offer, because while we can't tell you exactly what the carbon price should be, and both because we're never going to know some of the stuff and because some of it's just going to depend on ethical choices that we can't tell you what the right answer is going to be, we can tell you that there are way better and worse ways to get rid of carbon emissions, and that pricing carbon is going to be dramatically more effective than anything else you can do, provided we can figure out the politics side of it and make it happen.
And would to the good universe we have the problem of pricing it out of extinction? I mean, that would be really great, that we lowered carbon emissions so much that now what are we going to tax? But anyway, I'm so glad I asked that question, and it was a great answer. So my last words are, I already said it, what a show. What a great informative guest, and what a truly important topic that I am thrilled to have learned more about. I, for one, have been experiencing quite a bit more angst, even above my normal level of climate change angst of late, like when the UN came out and said code red. I'm like, code red, that's so yesterday. I mean, I've been living code red, buddy. I admit that I worry about when the Southwest will run out of water. When will our air quality be so compromised that we'll all be going out with a different kind of mask on? How are people going to afford the rising costs of food and gasoline and a myriad of other basic necessities? And I mean all people. And maybe the biggest one that keeps me up nights is, when are the masses really going to get it? That overconsumption is pretty much the root of all evil when it comes to all of this. I hope I live long enough. So, Derek, thank you for your work, for your commitment to researching and exploring very complex issues, such as how uncertainty should affect the design of climate policy and the interaction between energy systems and innovation and how to incentivize carbon removal, among other things. We need you. We need your work. And we all need to realize we are global citizens who have quite a bit to lose if we don't get on board with bringing about much needed changes. So my final thanks is always to you, our wonderful listeners, because as we all know, without you, there would be no us. So Derek, you can tell I pretty much speak from the heart, and my heart was very, very happy with this interview and your content and your passion for getting this in front of people, and my listeners will be thrilled. So thank you.
And thank you, Gina, for having me and for your great, great questions. And also for all the work you're doing, taking the work coming from the university and from AIR and bringing it in front of people as well.
I mean,
without that platform, we wouldn't be able to do that. So appreciate that.
I love it. Jim and I are on a mission, and it's the university is such a treasure trove of great things. And as a U of A alum, I want the world to know good things are happening there. In so many arenas. So anyway, I'm just honored that you got to spend time here and that you chose to do it. So thank you so much. And it's the first show of the new year. So that's, to me, even more important. And I hope it gets lots and lots and lots of listens. So thank you.
Happy New Year.